Welcome to the University of Limerick Research Impact Podcast Series. I'm your host, Professor Helena Lenihan, Chair of UL's Research Impact Committee. The ethos of the Research Impact Programme at UL is to recognise and celebrate research excellence and impact. In that spirit, we established the President's Research Excellence and Impact Awards. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by the recipient of the 2021 President's Research Excellence and Impact Award for early career researcher, Dr. Kieran O'Sullivan. Low back pain is a common symptom experienced by people from all age groups, countries, and economic status. Most of us have had some experiences of the challenges of dealing with low back pain, and unfortunately, the likelihood of being disabled by back pain has worsened in recent decades. After working in clinical practice as a physiotherapist for a number of years, Dr. Kieran O'Sullivan focuses on conducting excellent research which sheds new light on why back pain is such an ongoing challenge. Kieran is now ranked in the top 30 researchers on back pain in the world. He has obtained over 4 million euro in research funding and exemplifies all that is research excellence with impact. Kieran's research has also led to the development and testing of novel solutions for the treatment of back pain. In addition, Dr. O'Sullivan is the National Director of Professional Development for Physiotherapists. Without further ado, I would like to introduce Dr. Kieran O'Sullivan, Senior Lecturer in Physiotherapy at the School of Allied Health at the University of Limerick. Thanks for joining us today, Kieran, and first of all, to say warmest and sincerest congratulations on the award. Well done.
Thanks very much, Helena. Thank you very much.
So just to kick off today, Kieran, I'd like to get a sense from you, and I think our listeners would really like to get a sense of, you know, how universal is this challenge of low back pain? And do we know why the rates are increasing?
Sure. Well, back pain is pretty close to universal in that we can say that almost everyone at some point in their lives will get back pain. And that can sound quite scary and pessimistic, but I would argue it's also possibly reassuring in that when someone gets back pain, it's important to realize that it's no fun, it can be painful and scary, but it's not rare or unusual. And so it shouldn't be considered a dangerous situation in and of itself. So the big problem is not really getting back pain. The big problem is that the likelihood of becoming disabled by back pain, by that I mean not being able to go to work, do the things you like, your hobbies and sports and activities, the likelihood of being disabled is actually getting worse in recent years. And we have to stop and ask ourselves, what's going on? Well, we have a situation where back pain is getting worse, yet other chronic health conditions like diabetes and blood pressure are being managed better and the disability associated with them is becoming lower. Now, on one hand, people sometimes argue, well, that's because nowadays, you know, we're less active, more likely to be overweight, more time sitting. And these are all true. But if it was as nice and simple as that, blood pressure and diabetes would also be getting worse because they are also linked to sedentary time and obesity and so on. So there is something uniquely poor or bad about what I've been doing or what people like me have been doing in managing back pain for several decades. And I suppose as part of the mistakes that I've made and part of the challenges is that we've probably believed some things about back pain, some unhelpful myths that just further exacerbated the situation. And thankfully, we're starting to kind of do a better job of not passing those myths on to our patients.
That's really interesting. I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the myths. You know, there's vast levels of misinformation around many conditions out there, including back pain, of course. Could you, Kieran, give us an example of some of these myths that you just referred to and the impact they can have on patients on the ground?
Sure. So if we were in normal non-COVID times strolling around the campus of the university and we asked members of the public, what do you think causes, say, lung cancer or what do you think causes back pain? The likelihood is the public would be pretty accurate for lung cancer. They would have a pretty good understanding that, say, smoking is a big risk factor for lung cancer. However, if we ask them about back pain, they would overwhelmingly point to one of two things. The first one, either that, you know, something is damaged in my spine, like bulging discs, having wear and tear, or, you know, asymmetries in their pelvis and spine. Or secondly, they would blame specific postures and movements like bending too much or bending the wrong way or sitting the wrong way. And while these two things, you know, something being injured in your back or the way you move can play a role a little bit in back pain, they're a long way from the full picture of low back pain. By that, I mean the single biggest issue we face in terms of the myths and misinformation is that people still equate ongoing persistent back pain, the really disabling kind, with the idea of something being simply injured. And that's actually a really hard one to shift because for many people, it's their first or only experience of pain. So, for example, we've all had a kick in the shin or fallen and bruised our knee or our ankle. And so that kind of tells us that you get pain because something physical happens and a piece of skin or bone or ligament is injured. And so we learn at an early age that pain is injury. And of course, that is true to an extent. You know, people are not imagining that when they fell on their knee and cut their skin that it hurt. But the bigger error that we made and which we passed on to patients is that people think that when pain lasts, it's only because of how damaged the spine is or how much we provoke it by bending and lifting and twisting and so on. Whereas in contrast, all the evidence now tells us that, you know, most aches and pains we get from bangs and bruises and sprains heal, leaving no pain. And when pain persists, it's definitely not just about the initial tissue injury or the way we bend. Instead, it's far more about our overall body's ability to heal in the broader sense. And that considers things like my stress, my anxiety, my mood, my fitness, my strength, my sleep, how much I like or dislike the people I work with or the type of work I do. And so when we discuss this with patients, they're probably quite comfortable with the idea that it can make sense to them. They get that you can get headaches from things like sleep and stress rather than just injury. And other things like, for example, they get that high blood pressure, cold sores, things like eczema and, you know, psoriasis, that these can all be triggered by not just injury, but by sleep, stress and general health. In fact, anybody who's ever had a child report a pain in their tummy before going to school, you know, when they're worried, can relate to this. But while that conceptually makes sense to people, intuitively, our instinct is still back pain is, you know, about injury and damage and sprains. And then you see, you've got this problem that societally we expect it, and then the medical system kind of pushes people into this because we spend a lot of time focusing on traditional things. So if you start a new job, the focus in terms of back pain prevention will be on looking at your chair, looking at your manual handling technique, or then if you do get back pain, we'll send you for a scan to take a detailed picture of your back. And again, there's times when, you know, technology is wonderful. So, for example, if somebody's suspected of having a stroke, an MRI scan can be really useful. But almost every back pain guideline in the world for the last couple of decades acknowledges we shouldn't be scanning people as much as we have been. And as well as that, that it scares the hell out of people to be told they have things like disc degeneration in their back, because that sounds pretty dangerous. But it's mostly related to things like genetics and aging and so on. So, for example, a very typical situation we'll see in clinical practice or in our research is a person with persistent back pain who's been told by several clinicians, their GP, their physio, and so on, that their spine's badly damaged and that the everyday things they do, either for work or for, you know, family responsibilities and hobbies, that these things are dangerous. And so that patient can end up being scared, avoiding way too many things, becoming even more inactive, fed up, and worried. And when we actually look at their scans, you know, the scans they've been told are very scary, they often have what's a very much a normal looking spine for their age. Now, the key thing I would say there is for their age. As you know, this is a podcast, but you can see me right now, Helena. And as you can see from my face and my hairline, the years haven't been that kind. And I'm a rapidly balding middle-aged man. And while I mightn't like those features necessarily, or my wife might dislike them even more, I wouldn't call them a disease, and they definitely don't cause pain. So in the next 12 months, I might get a headache at some stage. But all the evidence suggests that's much more likely to be around a period of high stress, poor sleep, maybe sometimes having a bit too much wine, which, you know, a range of different things, not just baldness or tissue injury. And the frustrating and crazy thing is the risk factors for me getting back pain are similar, but intuitively as a society and as I suppose as healthcare providers, we've been very quick to blame the stuff you can see in a scan. And, you know, I'm pretty sure at my age, in my mid-40s, we would see disc degeneration in my back. And then once you see those things on the back, we forget about everything else and we stop looking for the important big picture risk factors. And to be honest, I've done this myself. So we end up with back pain with people with back pain seeming quite complicated to assess and treat because they don't fit a particular typical picture, even if their pain is pretty well understood in terms of the evidence.
That's really, really interesting. I mean, to me, as a non-expert, what you're getting at really is that it's multifactorial and we need to look at all the different things that impact on back pain. Now, from, you know, when we were looking at your research as part of the Research Impact Committee for this award, one of the things that came up is that your research, if I understand correctly, found that clinicians who treat back pain struggle to deal with what you refer to as complicated back pain cases. Can you explain why this is the case?
I suppose as a background, you know, when I first qualified as a physiotherapist, I worked with some great people and the work environment was very enjoyable, but I was pretty much lost as to what was happening with people with back pain. Because, you know, a treatment would seem to work with one patient and not another. And it would, I felt totally confused and out of my depth. And there was these patients who said things that just didn't make sense because, you know, it was clear their back wasn't injured, yet they weren't lying about how disabled and sore they were. And so that's probably informed some of the research we've done, where we've done a few studies on clinicians in different countries now, showing that pretty consistently, clinicians struggle with these somewhat complicated cases where there's clearly a lot of pain, but it's more than just tissue injury. And look, the good news, first of all, is that increasingly clinicians are aware there's more going on, that there's a need to treat the human and not just the scan, but they feel totally out of their depth and unprepared for this. So a typical situation is where they'll say, well, you know, someone should do something about, you know, the person's fears or stresses, but I don't think that person is me. And there's probably some very realistic barriers, you know, about why that is the case. So first of all, a lot of training at undergraduate level is still mostly relates to acute tissue injury. And again, that has a role. You know, people do fall and break limbs and arms and wrists, and we need to treat those as an injury. But when we think about chronic back pain, which is, you know, still the most costly health condition out there, we need to improve the knowledge and skills of physios, doctors, and nurses. And we're getting there, but it's slow. A second problem after education is that even if the person, like the, say, the physio or the doctor and the health service is open to offering the right care to a person with back pain, we don't have enough people with the right skills to see all the people with pain. So, for example, right now in the Midwest, if I saw somebody with persistent back pain and I felt strongly they could benefit from seeing a dietitian for their weight or a psychologist to help them with their mental health, it's actually pretty hard to find them. And then if they are available, they often cost quite a bit of money, which, you know, adds another layer of complications.
So, Kieran, that's really interesting. And, you know, it's kind of this holistic way of viewing things and it's lovely in theory. In reality, is that something that is improving or is it staying the same, or are there other countries maybe we could look to see how this kind of treating the patient as a whole works? Are we getting better or worse at this, or where are we in reality?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it comes back to then almost like how you can come up with the, you know, the ideal situation, and then you've got to try and match that to, well, where is this going to fit into our health service? So, for example, we've seen some studies using this approach which worked very well in a publicly funded healthcare system and failed miserably in a heavily privatized system like the United States. And there's a couple of reasons for that. For example, if your insurance, your government funding policy doesn't support what we might call the right kind of care and reinforces inappropriate care, you're going to have a big challenge. So, for example, you would hope that all clinicians will start off with the right intentions and then that the system doesn't get in their way. But unfortunately, we have situations where the clinicians don't often understand this and then the system adds fuel to the fire. So, for example, if you're in a situation, I'm here saying what we want to do is try and get a picture of the person's entire health. But if you're limited to a 10 to 15 minute appointment with your doctor or your physio, it's pretty hard to say how that's going to be useful. Now, no country has got it all figured out. And I suppose what we'll probably need to figure out in the next period of time is it's unlikely at any point in the near future that we're going to have in every primary care setting in Ireland a detailed, comprehensive, multidisciplinary team with GPs, physios, psychologists, and dietitians. I think we will need that on occasion, but I think it's much more likely that what we have to probably try and upskill and improve is the basic level of care provided by GPs, physiotherapists, and GP practice nurses and so on. and they can be trained and informed by other multidisciplinary programs. So that's probably where we've gone with some of the recent trials we've done, where we've said there is an ideal situation out there, but that's, you know, something we can plan and aim for. But right now we can't throw our hands in, up in the air and say, well, you know, until it's perfect, I'm not going to try and change anything. But there is a balance to be struck there, because again, I would be an advocate that we can get GPs and physiotherapists, for example, to talk to patients about their fears and stresses and anxieties without trying to become clinical psychologists. Because a lot of the time people are worried about just, my back is damaged because of an MRI scan. And if they're worried about, you know, the scan being scary, a GP or an orthopedic surgeon or a physio is as appropriate or as a psychologist in that regard.
Yes.
In contrast, if they have a significant underlying clinical depression or anxiety disorder, that's something quite distinct and different that needs distinct support.
It's complicated, and clearly one size won't fit all, but you raised some really interesting points, you know, about the kind of where did the theory and the reality meet and all the rest. Very interesting. I suppose, Kieran, somebody like me who's not in the medical or physiotherapy field, I've heard more about clinical trials in the last year than I've heard about in my whole life. Your research has led you to collaborate in a clinical trial with the Irish Health Service Executive. What was the result of this collaboration, and how did it benefit patients on the ground? Because we're all about excellent research with impact. So I'm interested to know the stakeholder of your research, an important one is the patient. Can you give us some insights into that clinical trial with the Health Service Executive in Ireland, please, Kieran?
Sure. So we completed and published a randomized trial, basically testing what I'm talking about here. Now, we had collaborators of mine had tested this intervention in Norway in a privatized clinic environment, and that seemed to be very promising. So again, in terms of testing whether this would work in a different country, we went to the Public Health Service in Ireland. And essentially, we tried to get people with ongoing disabling back pain and provide them with more comprehensive care, such as we've been discussing. So considering the whole person, not just the scan and the physical factors, and seeing if that would help. There were several steps involved in that, of course, getting the clinical sites on board. A particular focus, and I suppose, you know, commitment on our part was training clinicians to help them think about pain a little differently and feel comfortable that they can provide a little bit more comprehensive care. And then trying to develop suitable resources. So, for example, if I'm going to get a patient to think about coping with their stresses or improving their sleep, it's important that I'm able to direct them to suitable resources. The good news is that this approach, which was delivered over about 3 months, led to reduced disability. And importantly, that this wasn't just a short-term effect, that the effect lasted for over a year when we followed them up. And I would say this is an example of research with direct clinical benefits for obviously the patients in the study itself, but also the wider clinical community, as the resources we developed for that trial have now been delivered across multiple sites in the HSC and private sector, and of course, internationally as well. Now, it's nice to kind of say, well, that's great, that was one study, but I would say this is both a negative and a positive. That study, while promising, is a long way from optimal care. So it's not the perfect study, not the perfect intervention. And I would say that's good in a way, because it's a sign there's a lot more we can do. We only trained physiotherapists. We didn't go near the GPs, who I would say are key in managing the patient flow. And, you know, ideally the wider clinical team and indeed their family and their employer and everybody would ideally be singing from a similar hymn sheet. And then pragmatically, we didn't do things such as, like, we couldn't say who did or didn't get imaging, such as MRI scans. And ideally, people with chronic back pain, we don't want to keep them in the health service forever. But it is actually likely that at some point they'll have a flare-up, and it's important that you'll be able to manage that appropriately. And for chronic health conditions like depression and diabetes, we're quite comfortable with the idea that you don't treat people intensively for 3 months and then throw them out into the community and say, don't ever darken our door again. Yet for back pain, the orthopedic model that, you know, we treat them and then they should be cured still persists. So, for example, we are following that up with another trial at the moment where we're looking at slightly more continuous care, where we keep an eye on people for a longer period of time. And again, what we didn't do is look at truly integrating multidisciplinary care. So I would say the results of that trial were very encouraging in that they were pragmatic and promising, and still they leave huge room for improvement.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. You know, so far you've been talking about GPs communicating with physiotherapists, communicating with psychologists, and that's obviously a key kind of stakeholder group. But I think what's really important is this notion of communication science, and whether it's treating back pain or informing citizens around issues pertaining to vaccination programs, the need for strong evidence base, which is disseminated clearly, I think neither of us would argue that that is more vital than it's ever been. What I'm interested to know, Kieran, is your views on how can we as researchers, or you as a researcher in this field of back pain, how can researchers contribute towards tackling misinformation around medical conditions?
Sure. I think there's probably several different targets for dissemination, which we can discuss, some being easier than others, like the low-hanging fruit, and some of which I've probably had more success with than others. First of all, the easiest is likely training future clinicians. You know, my research informs my teaching, and, you know, the overall approach to clinical education in our programs at UL, and indeed many other institutions, are informed by that type of research. And, you know, I love my teaching, and we're lucky to have some superb students at the university who engage with it. And so while I could be negative and focus on the fact that we're not there yet, I'm enthusiastic about the future in that regard. The current students are leaving university with a much better sense of what pain is. So that's one thing in terms of communication with future clinicians. Secondly, then, I suppose, in terms of dealing with qualified clinicians, I suppose a big part of my research impact has been dealing with clinical workshops nationally and internationally, where we kind of go out and tell people about our research, but particularly how we apply that in practice. So, for example, last Saturday, I had an online clinical workshop with over 70 clinicians from over 15 countries. And I think they're critical to try and, I suppose, bridge that gap that unfortunately we still see sometimes between theory and practice. Within that role then as well, though, you know, we need to really try and, I suppose, get the professional groups to work together and I suppose, implement this into practice. So on a related issue, I'm currently Director of Professional Development for our national body, the Irish Society of Chartered Physios, and I'm also on the professional practice group of the European region of World Physio. And the reason I bring those up is that we have to try and get within society these professional groups to, yes, they'll always have focus on promoting their own interests, but really trying to promote the best care for patients. And I see these roles as being critical in changing the overall discourse among professional groups about how we manage back pain and change practice and guidelines and all the rest of it.
Really interesting, Kieran. I mean, you know, I notice in your submission that you have a lot of experience outside of Ireland as well, that you worked in Qatar. Can you give us some insights into that? And, you know, does it work differently in different country contexts? Or are there some key issues that are important in terms of misinformation and communication around these issues? I'm just really interested to know, you know, the context outside of Ireland as well, because I know you've done some fantastic work on the ground in that regard too.
If you think about the biology of the body, that's not going to change, and the risk factors involved with back pain aren't going to change. But yes, there are significant cultural differences between different countries. We touched on some of them already, public versus private incentives and so on. But particularly if I could give you one example of differences that are important and show how tricky these things can be. We know that one of the most underrated risk factors for back pain is poor sleep. So if you take a group of people now, whether it's teenagers or middle-aged people, if there's a group of them who are pain-free and don't sleep well, they're much more likely to get pain in the future. And so sleep is one of those things that we can change and is important for pain and general health. If you go to a country like Qatar, where I was for 3 years, there's a very different culture around sleep, and particularly in the summer months. So for example, in the summer, it's really, really hot. And if people want to socialize, especially outside, they're only going to do it really late at night. And you might be talking about going meeting your friends from 11 o'clock at night until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And then for an awful lot of the people in Qatar, there'll be early morning prayers at, you know, a time like 5:30 or something like that. So you end up with a situation for a large chunk of people where their typical night sleep might be 3 to 4 hours, which is a very different to what we think about. But then they're even in the evening time, they might nap, and I say nap, for maybe 2 hours or maybe 2.5 hours. So their total sleep is different in terms of their pattern to ours, but they still sleep a certain way. Now, in all the evidence we read, which is almost all based on Western countries, one of the big things they say is people should avoid long naps and get a big, long, uninterrupted night's sleep. I would question how acceptable that would be to try and implement that in a country like Qatar. And culturally, it was interesting to me how, you know, I almost had to let go of some of my beliefs around what was appropriate, if that makes sense, you know, like as
yes.
you go to bed early and this idea that, you know, an hour before midnight is better than 2 hours after it. So there's differences, first of all, in that regard. And then obviously, you know, some of the other things that are interesting are around, like, I suppose, what's appropriate and I suppose issues around like different cultures. And for example, also male-female differences. So for example, when I was in Qatar, it was very rare for me to see a female patient. And almost, you know, it's interesting in terms of how appropriate it is or not to ask people about their roles and how their gender affects their roles. And these things, again, these arise in many countries, but there are probably some distinct challenges in the Middle East in that regard.
That's really interesting. That's why I couldn't let this go without asking you about your experience in Qatar. Really, really interesting. Another question I don't think I could let go, because I think everybody listening to the podcast would say, why didn't you ask Kieran O'Sullivan about? And the about here is, you know, we're doing this podcast here today virtually. I'm sitting at home and you're sitting at home. With the move to the virtual world, we're now spending more time sitting at our screens than ever before. And the question I'm dying to ask you, Kieran, is there an ideal sitting posture?
Great question, and one we'll hear a lot. In the short answer is no, there's definitely not one single ideal posture. We come in all kinds of shapes and sizes, and we can be pretty sure that it doesn't look like we should make everyone sit or move a certain way. So I would divide my response then into two things. First of all, if you're pain-free currently, don't worry about posture and think about all the things that can cause pain. Okay? But if you're pain-free, I wouldn't give it a second thought. If you, on contrast, had some pain, and lots of people in the last year will have got some pain, you know, a small contributing factor within that could have been, now you're sitting at a different chair and at a different desk. But by no means is that the only thing that's changed. So, for example, if we look at all the chaos of the last year, we'd want to look at if you've developed back pain in the last year, your stresses, your sleep, your diet, how much freedom have you had to exercise, to socialize. For me, I could feel my own back getting tight when we were trying to combine doing my teaching and homeschooling the kids and all these things. And if you were going to give me in January or February a choice of what we'll do to treat my back pain, I would have asked you to take care of the homeschooling of the kids and give us a few interrupted hours, and I'd happily sit on the floor for you. The challenge, however, against that is when we think about posture, most of our beliefs are based on aesthetics and the idea of what it is to look elegant, appropriate, you know, and we see this especially in our own studies. There's a bigger pressure and an expectation on women to look a certain way. So it's a bit more acceptable for me to slouch in my chair and let my belly hang out and have a greater pressure on women, especially to sit with your shoulders back and walk around as if you could deport yourself a certain way. So the only time I would say you should really ever think about your posture if you're pain-free is, you know, if you're going for an interview or going on a date, if you're slouched, it'll probably be seen as disinterested or lazy or unmotivated. But in terms of pain, we've probably made too much of a thing of it. And only if you're uncomfortable should you start to think about finding a way to sit. And then if you are thinking about the way you sit, look around you. The people who don't have pain sit relaxed. They sit back into the chair and they try not to carry too much tension in the body.
That's really interesting, because I think we've all become a bit obsessed with, you know, are we sitting in the proper way as we look at these screens? But I think what you're saying is if you don't have a problem, work away as we are. Just sticking with the COVID and the pandemic, I'm just curious to know, and I'm sure the listeners will be, Kieran, you know, given the specific focus of your own research, has your research been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic?
So, of course, it's very hard not to have been unaffected by the pandemic. But honestly, I was relatively lucky in that there were no major projects hugely affected. So, for example, if it was a few months earlier that this all happened, one of our clinical trials would have been severely affected. So in terms of work and the projects, there have been some people much more significantly affected than my own work.
Interesting, because I think it's affected researchers to varying degrees. When we talk about researchers, we often think about the lone scholar working away on the research and then other people who work very much as part of collaborative teams and co-author publications. And my own view, and I know from our discussions going back over the years, I think we're both of the opinion there's room for all types of researchers. But I think from listening to you, clearly your research is very much in the spirit of collaboration. So whilst acknowledging that there's room for all different types of research and all different types of researchers, I'm interested to know, what has been your experiences of collaborative research? And is it something that comes naturally to healthcare?
I think it does come somewhat naturally to healthcare, because in my area, there's little that can be done outside of collaborative teams. And I've been very fortunate, to be honest, to work with some really impressive, helpful and decent colleagues in UL and internationally. And, you know, I could get into naming them all, but they know who they are. And without them, you know, my research wouldn't have succeeded to any extent. I think in my own research, my links to clinical practice, both through the clinical workshops and then the roles with the professional body, are particularly strong. And I think that's probably helped me get some of the clinical work done. But I expect that in future years, a greater focus of my research will be trying to further expand the network of professionals whose practice for back pain I'm seeking to influence. By that, I mean, we'll say, if you take the average person presenting, let's say, to a physio department with back pain, the physio will not have been the first person they'll have seen. They'll at least have been a GP. There might have been another couple of clinicians. There might have been a radiologist and a surgeon. And there will also maybe have been an occupational health person advising them as well. And we need to get not everybody singing uniformly, but to stop some of the mixed messages that are out there. You know, anybody who's listening to this who's had back pain, it's highly likely they'll have been given two or three conflicting stories, which adds to the sense of chaos and confusion. And I suppose I hope that over the next few years, as we work together in groups, that things like professional rivalries or kind of issues around remuneration don't stand in the way of that.
So, Kieran, you've touched on it there, and we're drawing now towards the end of this very interesting podcast. But before we conclude, I'd like to ask you, where to from here for Kieran O'Sullivan and his research? You know, what do you plan on doing in the near future? How do you plan to take all this really fascinating work forward? Can you give us some ideas in that regard? It'd be really helpful.
So, you know, we already touched on the ideal world and the real world. So in the real world, like most researchers, you know, I don't have the luxury right now of being able to do research full time. And so, you know, teaching and administrative tasks are part of my work commitments. In terms of the research, we have just followed up the Irish clinical trial, which we discussed, with a feasibility trial in the NHS in Britain and a definitive trial in Australia. And we should have data from both of those, you know, for publication by the end of this year. And of course, that will again tell us more about the generalizability and the transferability, different healthcare systems and so on. I've obviously got several PhD students doing projects right now, most of it on back pain, but, you know, a few other aches and pains, because while the focus here is on back pain, we see the same risk factors for neck pain, knee pain and hip pain and so on. And of course, like all researchers, I'll be out of my research funding begging bowl pretty soon. And of course, it's a very competitive environment in terms of funding, but I'm hopeful that the kind of work I'm doing aligns with current approaches in the HSE around better integrating patient care.
Really interesting. Just to conclude, I'd like to say many thanks for your time today, Kieran. And again, congratulations on your award. It's a fantastic achievement. So well done. Your work truly exemplifies research excellence with impact, which is helping patients and clinicians all around the world. Through your network of international collaborators across research, education and practice, you've uncovered new evidence with the patient's welfare, as we've seen today in this podcast, at the very core of your journey of discovery. You've been listening to Dr. Kieran O'Sullivan, recipient of the University of Limerick's President Research Excellence and Impact 2021 Early Career Researcher Award. Dr. O'Sullivan's research has been primarily supported by the Health Research Board, the Irish Research Council, Horizon 2020, and the National Health and Medical Research Council in Australia. Dr. O'Sullivan's research contributes towards the UN Sustainable Development Goal 3, Good Health and Wellbeing. If you would like to find out more about research impact at the University of Limerick, please go to our website, ul.ie/research impact.